This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the February 7th, 2017 edition of the DRF Players Podcast, show 210. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you alongside the usual crew. Coming to us from the DRF offices in New York, we have Mike Hogan.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for asking. And coming to us from Planet Texas, where he's got all kinds of interesting things happening, I'm sure. We have the 2015 NHC Tour champion, Jonathan Kitchen.
It's been so long, you forgot. You forgot the year. It's been so long since I've had any success. I should tell everyone that piece you wrote about me, what's happened to Jonathan Kitchen. I did make you buy me an expensive breakfast with, they charged for refills on orange juice, but I didn't give a damn because
He had four orange juices. It was unbelievable. Yeah. He was doing it on purpose. I could see his bladder was about to burst, and it was like, let's have another orange juice. I deserved it, but I did get my line in there, whatever happened to Jonathan Kitchen. I was happy with that. I thought I had reverse mushed you into all-time success ranges when you blew up on the scoreboard on day one at the NHC. Unfortunately, some bad luck and whatnot prevented the full reverse mush from happening. But I did appreciate your it was very adult of you to allow me to write that piece. It was a special request from my editor, I will say. It did not spring forth from my brain fully formed, but I was happy to get it up there, and I appreciate you rolling with the punches. I believe there were a couple of drinks and maybe some dumplings, too, on top of that $75 breakfast.
No doubt, yeah. Oh, I forgot about that. I did forget about that, yeah. I was gonna get my money out of it.
Well, I appreciated you being such a good sport about it. Maybe tournaments is a good place to start, actually, because DRF Tournaments last week announced these new partnerships with a couple of cool tournaments. I'm not sure what your history is in any of these events. Three new partners. We're running feeders and credit builders towards, and we'll be running the qualifiers on the weekends. The Del Mar contest in July, which I know you've played in. Also coming up real soon, the Horse Player World Series with its expected $1 million purse, and also the Win Contest, which is very notable. A lot of players complain about the NHC, it's winter racing. I mean, they have this excuse a lot less with the Pegasus, I suppose. But then, heck, there were some of them who complained about that, too, for other reasons. But the idea being, you know, it takes place in the winter. It's not the greatest racing. Well, how about this? The Win Contest, it's just Del Mar and Saratoga, takes place over the weekend of August 4th and 5th this year. JK, have you ever played? We'll go one by one. Have you played in the Win Contest?
I played in all three, and I've got positive things to say about all of them. First off, the Horse Player World Series is fun. It's about 700 people. It's very NHC feeling-ish. The difference there is it's 20 optional races. There's no mandatory, so you can go as you will there. And I believe there's no cap. I'm pretty sure there's no cap.
No, there's a cap, but a certain part of your money is uncapped, and then the rest of it is. It's a really smart compromise.
Yeah, I think I think you're really placing a $10 win place, and your first $2 is not capped. After that, you are capped. It's a really fun event. I know the Matisse family makes it, like, I think it's literally their family reunion. Like, every child that is a Matisse shows up to this event, and they blow the thing out. So that's always a fun one. I've been to that twice. Nick Tamro and I finished 22nd once before, so I enjoyed that. Del Mar is phenomenal. It's a big money tournament, but it's phenomenal. It's in the summer. It's in the middle of their meet. They put you up in this room on the very top floor, on the sixth floor, that sits right about the eighth pole. Literally, I cannot tell you a better place to watch a race than from that room. From that patio, you can see the move. We were lucky enough to see Songbird break her maiden from that room at Del Mar. So that tournament's phenomenal as well. And then the Win is a lot of fun. It's about $2,000 entry. It's a big prize pool. The winner's gonna get guaranteed to get six figures on that event. Johnny Avello at the Win takes care of Horse Players. He's one of the sports books in Vegas that get it when it comes to us guys. And that was a really fun event, too. Usually about 250 people there, so it's kind of a good little mini mini NHC in terms of kind of getting into Vegas and being able to kind of rub shoulders with other horse players. But the racing menu, like you mentioned, is phenomenal. It's Saratoga and Del Mar. It does go for long days.
Yes.
Because as you can imagine, Saratoga starts fairly early on the West Coast, and then you got Del Mar. So it's a long day, but it's a lot of fun, good racing. And another thing interesting about the Wynn, just for people that haven't played in, there's no leaderboard. The leaderboard is only posted at the end of day one and at the end of day two. So people never know where they are. You just got to pick what you like, play what you like, and see what happens there. There's also a double bet in that event where you get I don't know if it's a $2, $4 situation.
I think it's $2 and then the double bet is $4. That sounds right.
Right. And so that's another interesting fact of that tournament. If you hit your cap horse with a double, you're in good shape. So all three events are great. I'm excited to get on there and try to get qualified for all three of them.
I would imagine most winners do have to hit that double bet on at least one day, and possibly if the field gets big enough, you might have to think about hitting it on both. So that's an interesting way to reward players' strongest opinions of the day in a similar but not quite the same way as live bankroll contests. That's a really good point about the leaderboard. I'd kind of forgotten that about the Wynn. That'll be a good article. I've got a lot of cool contest content coming up over the course of the next few weeks, and we'll do some in-depth summaries of these tournaments and talk about different strategies that players might want to employ. Jonathan, you mentioned about the bigger buy-in of Del Mar, but that's the beauty part of playing in these feeders and credit builders. Typically, they run Wednesday through Sunday on DRF tournaments. Some of them you can get in for as little as $10 and start your journey to these big events. It's a great way to dip your toe in the water if you're new to contests, and if you're a more seasoned contest player, it's a good thing to become, I would say, an essential part of your business plan, getting on there, building your bank, and shooting for the biggest tournaments of the year. So that's just something I wanted to make sure that everybody was aware of.
First time I played in the Del Mar tournament, I qualified. And in fact, a friendship was born in a qualifier where I got nosed out by enemy at one point, now a friend, Ryan Flanders. And then a couple of weeks later, I actually did get my qualification as I was literally in the backseat of a car, of an Uber, leaving the Hawthorne tournament. I was in the Uber playing online with the Uber driver's Wi-Fi, and I won the Del Mar. I won the Del Mar seat online on the way back from the Hawthorne tournament. So good memories for me.
Now, Jonathan, I had planned on spending a lot of the show making fun of Mike for his isotherm pick, but now I'm thinking of shifting, or anti-pick, I should say. But now I'm thinking of shifting, just making fun of you for overusing the word literally. What do you think?
That's probably fair. I probably use it a little bit. It's probably fair. I'm gonna be so self-conscious about it moving. I'm literally gonna be self-conscious about it moving forward.
I'll send you some grammar articles. We don't have to do this part on the air about my feelings of the word literally. But before we move on to actual horse racing, I cannot get this year's Super Bowl out of my head. I think it has so many interesting applications for gambling in general and horse racing in specific, but given just the craziness of the events. And one of the ways I think it applies to racing is the way that narrative is being applied to this particular football contest. For those of you who have been living under a rock and didn't see, this was 2.5 quarters of absolute domination by the Atlanta Falcons. Brady missing receivers, looking so bad at some point that I exclaimed loudly to the room I was with, "Tom Brady is a corpse." And then everything turned on a dime. Everything went the Patriots' way for the last 23 minutes. And, of course, they pulled off what amounts to the greatest upset in Super Bowl history, and certainly on the short list for NFL history. But what interests me about it a little bit is the way that narrative is being applied. This idea that somehow the Patriots couldn't lose. Tom Brady, he just willed it to happen. He needs the two touchdowns and the two-point conversions. And you know, with what Goodell did to him at the beginning of the year, he just wasn't going to let it happen. I just think it's the silliest thing I've ever heard, folks. I think what this is, to me, is a case of, and it happens once in a while, let's say you had a bunch of coin flips, and let's say there were 15 coin flips, and let's say 13 or 14 out of those coin flips ended up heads. That's going to happen if you flip the coin enough times. This isn't a case of the coin developing a will to turn up heads. There's a lot of randomness involved in a situation like this. I'm hoping one of you guys is going to want to argue with me and tell me that this result was preordained, but that's the way I see it. It just reminds me very much of things we see on the racetrack and stories people want to tell about why things happen, because it's very hard as human beings to just accept the role of random chance. JK, maybe we'll have you go first as the former football coach. What was, did you watch the game, first of all, and what did you think?
I did watch the game. I've told a lot of people, I retired from sports betting. I think it's a, you know, it's a 50-50 proposition, but you don't get paid 50-50. And I actually heard Andy Serling say one time that betting on sports is like a 3-hour inquiry, and I couldn't agree more. It's just painful. But it was the Super Bowl, and I wasn't going to watch it without having some action. So I made a very, very small wager on the over. And thought it was over in the first in the first quarter.
Over. That's the suck out of all time. I never want to hear you complain about a bad beat again.
Yeah. So, but here's what I'll say: the biggest thing that stood out to me, and when it comes to the Patriots, and also the same way I feel about Alabama, is yes, they have really good players, but they are so meticulously coached. It's unbelievable. I can promise you, especially from my experience coaching football, those 2-point conversion plays that the Patriots won, that they executed in the last two times they scored, that was the only reason that the game even went to overtime. I promise they have been practicing those plays for at least 6 weeks, and they have always known when the opportunity came that was exactly what they were going to do. I bet you they didn't even have to huddle. They knew they were running the first one. They were going to do the direct snap to the running back. And the second one, they were going to throw the ball to Danny Amendola off of that short motion. And to me, that's the difference, is how well they're coached, how well they're prepared for all situations. And that's what made the difference.
We've talked before about how I think Belichick would make a great professional horse player should he ever choose to go that way in his life. And I thought that game showed why. And by the way, I didn't mean to say I didn't think the Patriots should be favored or wouldn't win the vast majority of times those two teams played, despite what happened in the first 2.5 quarters. I just thought the idea that it was somehow like preordained and the rush to attribute what happened to something supernatural rather than just some of the crazy randomness that happens in life. That's more what I was commenting on. Now, Mike, you're not a football guy, but yet even you took to Twitter to tweet about the Super Bowl. Why don't you tell us about that and just share your thoughts generally on this discussion?
Yeah, you know, I didn't watch the game, and I didn't even watch a single down of the whole football season. So I could talk much more about you know, Stabler and Staubach than I could Brady and Matt Ryan. Is that the name of the other guy?
Yes, that's the name of the MVP of the NFL, Mike.
See, there you go. But I did tweet out a couple things. One was one I saw getting retweeted. Skip Bayless at some point had said, "And ladies and gentlemen, the Super Bowl champion is the Atlanta Falcons." And I retweeted that and said, "Here it is, the exact moment that the Falcons lost the game."
We talked about anti-mushes. That's just a plain old mush, yes.
Oh, yeah, that's a serious mush. And then I also just tweeted out, Atlanta Falcons equal cheap speed.
Pretty funny and not wholly inaccurate. Jonathan, let me ask you about what I think everybody, it's so easy in hindsight, but this was one where I think a lot of people, I respect it so much more if somebody said this before the fact. I didn't say this out loud. Some people probably did. The idea that the Falcons have the ball, a field goal away from icing it, at the Patriots' 21-yard line, and are calling a pass play in that situation. As a football coach, you know, is this in the same territory as the not running Marshawn Lynch 2 years previous? Is this that level of gum up?
No, I think that they're a little bit different. To me, I think as a coach, you practice, you prepare, and you have an understanding with your players about what the expectation is. I know that at the high school level, we preached every day on Thursday. We preached. We jogged around the goalpost with our players on offense, and we said, "Reserve the right to kick." And we'd make them chant that in between periods, "Reserve the right to kick, reserve the right to kick." When you have a player like Matt Ryan, who's been in the league as long as he's been in the league and had the success he's had, as a coach, you expect that your quarterback, veteran quarterback, will not take a sack. And ultimately, I don't blame the coaches for that. It was a mistake by the player. you know, from high school, he's known that situation. He cannot take a sack. He's got to throw the ball to his mother up in the 14th row and be done with it. And the fact that he took a sack will ultimately cost them the football game.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds about right to me. Do you remember, by the way, J.K., when we originally talked about pro football and professional horse players, who you nominated as a coach who you thought would do well in racing? I want to revisit this because it shocked me so much at the time.
Jeez, I don't even. Did I say Chip Kelly?
No. I mean, I think you can make a case for Chip Kelly, despite the difficulties he's had the last two seasons.
Oh, I think it was Rex Ryan.
Big Rex. Oh, it just shocked me. He seems like the most impulsive kind of guy who's going to get hot one day and then absolutely blow his bankroll down to nothing the next day. But what was there something I missed there, or you want to revise that statement?
No, I think that a lot of this sport, I think we actually talked about this, a lot of horse racing is the people you surround yourself with and the information that you can share with people that you are friendly with personally and professionally. And I think Rex has got a phenomenal personality. I think people like to be around Rex, and I'd imagine that he'd be a fun guy to go to the track with, and so I would imagine he would find some success.
Well, I don't know if he's been rehired yet as a coordinator somewhere, a job he's excelled at in the past, but this might be the window of opportunity to get Rex in the Logan suite if any of his friends are listening. So we'll just throw that out there. All right, that's enough about that. Let's move on to the racing over the weekend. There was a whole lot of interesting stuff. But before we get to the implications for the three-year-old racing, I want to talk about the performance this weekend that made my jaw drop. As one of my favorite race callers likes to say, it was a real, oh, look at her go situation with Unique Bella out in California. Just visually, I don't know what the number came back, but just visually, a real jaw dropper to me. And I was super impressed. And well, on this very program, I was skeptical of the early Oaks chatter after the previous race. This one had me thinking, you know, this isn't one I'm in a hurry to bet against. Mike Hogan, we'll start with you. What did you think of the performance in general?
You know, I actually saw the PPs before I saw the replay of the race, and I didn't realize that she didn't have the lead. I missed that she was third early. I thought she just outbroke and wired the field. And then when I watched the replay, it was even more impressive, the way she ended up getting kind of floated wide, probably four or five wide on the first turn, ranged up without being asked at all on the backstretch. And you could tell once she passed those other horses, the jockeys got a little bit nervous, like, oh boy, we better ask our horses now because we're just going to get buried before the second turn. You know, Mike Smith just never moved on her. She looked incredibly professional. Granted, you know, it was only a four-horse field, and I think a lot of us have been skeptical about Champagne Room going forward, but she still looked really, really good. The buyer came back at 98. That was her first time going two turns. You know, I mean, this is one where, kind of like her stablemate Songbird, if she stays healthy, I don't see any reason why she can't run the table this year in the three-year-old filly division.
A 98, that is impressive. I hadn't looked at the numbers yet, but that certainly puts her up to another level, and a level that does suggest that we should start believing this Oaks hype. Or should we, Jonathan Kitchen?
No, I said last time I was a little bit concerned about one thing, and that was some clues that had come out about her ability to relax, and she did that. She middle moved into that hot pace and drew away easily. Here's what I'll say. I've got three acquaintances, that are probably the most, I love them, but they're the most cynical people in racing that I'm around. And they're the type of people that were not fans of Songbird, were not fans of American Pharoah. And all three of them are singing their praises of Unique Bella. So for me, that means she'll probably never lose again. And that she's the greatest horse we've ever seen. So she's exciting. She's exciting, and it's we're lucky to get to watch her run. She's going to be a lot of fun to watch progress. She seemed like she's pretty special.
What do you think the difference maker was for the cynics? Simply that the figure came back so high? Because, I mean,
yeah,
those other horses you mentioned had lighter speed figure performance. performances, but they've been just as visually awesome. Is that really the difference when it comes to having some hard data to back up the visual impression?
Yeah, I would think so. Songbird, as a 3-year-old, she kept running kind of lower 90 numbers. You know, the Saint Isabel is a little bit higher, but she wasn't getting kind of pressured. She was just kind of loping along on the front end. I think that the figure and the middle move and ease in which she did it was what was so impressive. You know, I was like driving into the office this morning. I was thinking something that I have to start doing a better job of is identifying middle moves. They're harder to find, middle fractions. They're a lot harder to find. I learned that lesson last year with Catherine Sophia, and I've kind of gotten away from identifying that within races. But those middle moves are the ones that are, I think, the hardest moves for people to see, or for the public to see, and I think they're really important. I think that's probably part of the reason that Unique Bella is getting some of the credit she got because of the way she moved in the middle of that race.
Yeah, I think one good tool for that, a very handy visual tool, you can obviously use the Moss pace figures as well, but the way those time form figures are coded for pace, with the red color indicating the fast pace at the various segments of the race. And while I agree with you, Jonathan, the middle move, that's where the races are typically won and lost on the turn, but I'd even go a step farther and just say, look for horses doing their running in the fastest part of the race, period. And you're sure to find some overlays going forward. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually talked about this. And this is not a red board. I'm just an example. It helped me find a horse in the NHC that I normally would not have found if I didn't watch the replay. Because on paper, I didn't see it. I didn't see that there was that middle move into the fastest part of the race. And that's kind of why watching replays and taking notes is important. When you can pop in a note in your formulator, fast middle of the race, 3 weeks later, the horses come back. 4 weeks later, the horses come back, and you identify that horse moved into the fastest part of the race. Man, it's a really, really sneaky handicapping angle if you can identify them.
Definitely an underrated trip handicapping angle that I first learned about in not picking winners, but maybe it was the winning horse player, the buyer book, that really goes very deep into how he eventually started using trip handicapping principles when the market started catching up and the figures alone weren't enough. That book has a lot of great trip handicapping angles and notations that you can neatly put right into Formulator via your trip notes, and they just give you a much more three-dimensional look at a race, and it works in all directions. It works and takes a performance that already looked superstar like Unique Bella and make you say, hey, here's this extra reason for it to be legit. And it also takes a lot of fourths beaten 10 and makes you realize, you know what, this horse is actually pretty good and is worth taking a lot more seriously when it comes to the next time.
I have a question. I was listening to Bick on the way in, and he had Hollendorfer on, and Hollendorfer said something that is just an interesting question, an interesting thought, and I want to see what you guys think. But essentially what he said was, I don't understand the public's fixation with running the fillies against the boys. And I think the end of his quote was, I guess it's just because of Rachel.
Huh. What an odd thing to say. I mean, I think it should be obvious. Fillies have proven historically and do all the time in Europe that the best of them can be the best of the boys. And so I think people want to see the best horses prove that they're the best horses overall, as opposed to, to me, that's almost like saying, why does anybody watch pro basketball when you can watch NCAA basketball? And I guess there are people who do say that, to be fair, but I never really got it. I've always wanted to see the best against the best. Now, that said, I'm not saying a filly has to or this or that. I'm just saying when they show that kind of freakish talent like Unique Bella or her stablemate Songbird, who I imagine he was more maybe talking about. I don't know which one he was talking about. He could be talking about either. But like for me, this year, Songbird having accomplished what she did last year, a date with the boys for me down the line would be super exciting. And people want to see it because we are fans of the sport and we want to see great sport. I almost can't understand. And I'm not like a big always run the fillies against the boys guy at all. But I mean, I think it's very easy to understand. Mike Hogan, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I think people just want to know, look, they know she's the best 3-year-old filly we've got, just like last year Songbird was the best 3-year-old filly we had. And so your question always becomes, okay, let's see how good she is outside of her division. Let's see how good she is and how she stacks up against those that are not in those restricted races. And, you know, I think it's just natural that people are curious. They want to know how good someone is. And if like you said, Pete, you've got a high school player who's just so much better, you want to see how they stack up against the best in the college ranks or the college and the pros. It makes sense to me. That said, I wouldn't knock them at all if they just ran the table with the filly races, and the first time she doesn't run against three-year-old fillies is in the distaff.
And I agree with that completely. I'm not saying, oh, let's run Unique Bell against the boys. I'm just saying you've got to understand where people are coming from who want to
right.
see it. It's not some crazy idea. But, I mean,
right.
as we saw, you can also make the case, and this might stir up the classic argument that we've reiterated in so many different fashions on the show. If you want to talk about Rachel Zanyatta, you know, there might be a reason. I'm pretty sure there was a reason why Rachel at four wasn't Rachel at three, and why Zanyatta was able to keep doing that for so long. And
right.
I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say they picked and chose their spots to face the boys, as opposed to coming up with the most ambitious three-year-old filly campaign in, you know, certainly my lifetime, and probably going back farther than that. There's a causal connection in my mind between Rachel as she was at four and Zanyatta as she was able to continue to be, and how often they face the boys. So yeah, not questioning it at all, not questioning the decision to run against her own sex. I'm just also fully understanding why people would want to see it. What's your take on that, JK?
I mean, the same reason we wanted to see Chrome and Arrogant run against each other, because people want to see, they want to see in sport, they want to see people pushed to the extreme so that they have an opportunity to see a great performance. The same reason that Tom Brady, the game the other night was so magical, because he did something that he wasn't expected to do. It was expected to be over, and he came back and won, and now people are saying it's one of the greatest Super Bowls ever. I think it's the same thing with Unique Bella. We just want to see her pushed to the extreme. If she's the best three-year-old out there, how exciting is the Oaks, really, if she's just better than all of them? It's not as exciting as it would be if she loaded it into the gate on Saturday with 19 other horses and was one of the few females to win the Kentucky Derby. That's more exciting. So as fans, I think it's unfair for Jerry to kind of not see it from our perspective.
Well, unfair is too strong. I mean, here's the thing. Jerry, and this is a great thing to think about trainers when you're looking at every aspect of their lives. They are not here for what we're here for. I mean, yes, some of them do gamble, but and I don't want to castigate anybody, but I'm kind of tempted to say that the best of them aren't there for the gambling. The best of them aren't there to put on a show. The best of them are there to take care of horses, and that's all they care about. And somebody, and I understand, I can find sympathy for the dwarf here in, you know, it's not helping him train his horses, specifically this horse, and make the best decisions he can by this filly to have 80 mopes like me saying, oh, we want to see this, we want to see this. So I think for him, it's just distracting from his core mission, so he doesn't want to hear about it. And it's just a lesson in how different life is to me for trainers than it is for horse players. And some of the reasons why, you can extrapolate from that, some of the reasons why, as much respect as I have for horsemen, they don't always make the best handicappers, because yeah, it's their job to pick spots, especially claiming trainers, but they have other stuff to worry about. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
No, absolutely, 100%. I mean, what's best for the owner is for the horse to run in the Oaks, win the Oaks, you know, then come back, win the Alabama, and be worth more money than you can imagine as a broodmare. That's what's best for the owner. So, because that's the path of least resistance, right? I mean, obviously, if she wins the Derby, she's worth a lot more than that. But, you know,
that's a great question. And we'd have to ask a breeding industry person. Maybe Mike knows. A filly who wins the Derby, how much more valuable is she than a filly who wins the Oaks and the Alabama? Does it really matter?
I don't know. Black type is black type. And, you know, I mean, it's interesting that we're talking about this, because I was looking at what Unique Bella sold for at auction and wondering what she looked like in the ring, or if maybe she had some sort of vet issues. This is a tappet out of Unrivaled Bell, who won the Ladies Classic, essentially the distaff, won a BC race, and sold for $400,000. Yep. You know, that's a seven-figure pedigree, in my opinion. And, you know, it's easy to say after the fact, but what a deal.
No, going in, you'd put that over under, like what you're saying, Mike. For sure. And it was, I brought that up actually after the last race as one of the reasons why it just gave me a little bit of pause about how good she was going to be. I'm sure some reporter, one of the excellent DRF reporters, has probably already sussed this out. If we go back through the DRF archive for Plus members, we could find out what the story is about that sale price. If not, I'm sure it'll be coming out ahead of her next race. But that's a really good point.
Here's the thing. I don't like I said, I'm newly starting to try to pay attention to breeding because I think it's really interesting in sales and all that stuff. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say, if this filly were to win the Kentucky Derby, then it feels like she would be the most expensive, like private, you know, like if you sold her at auction as a broodmare prospect, she would like break records. I mean, what, Havre de Grace sold for $10 million? Would this filly being by Tappet not be worth just an astronomical amount of money as a Kentucky Derby winner? I don't know the answer, but it sure feels like it.
Let's put a pin in that part of the discussion, and we all have context in the breeding business. Let's try to see what, let's get some educated guesses of people of what those two restricted to fillies grade ones would be worth for her as opposed to a Derby. I honestly don't know the answer. I think it's an interesting conversation. I agree with what you said, Jonathan, that what's best for the owner and by extension what's best for the filly is to stay against fillies for now. But I'll just ask you point blank, Mike Hogan. You owner, are you pointing for the Kentucky Derby or are you pointing for the Kentucky Oaks?
The Oaks, absolutely. And part of that, in my mind, is the change to the point system. Because in the past, you could have run her against the fillies and then tried her in the Derby for the first time against boys. Instead, now you have to try her against boys twice. She has to run well enough to get enough points in, what, I guess the Santa Anita Derby. And then she has to run against 19 other boys. So you're going to do it at least twice before she turns 3.5. And that's a lot for a young filly. This, you know, she didn't race much at two. She took a little while to get to the track. She, you know, you're going to go slowly with her. That's throwing her in the deep end pretty quickly. And look, I would rather see her continue to race on at four or even five than have another three-year-old that burns out like we had with Rachel.
Take that out of consideration. Let's say that it was like the old days and she could just run in the Derby. Would you do it then?
Oh, I don't know. It's too many hypotheticals. Maybe. Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends upon how she's doing that day. It depends upon what it looks like that Derby field is lining up. And we'll talk about it in a second. But right now, it looks like we've got no monsters on the boys' side. So maybe. But from a financial standpoint, I don't think you gain much more. And there's a lot more to lose.
All right. Well, we'll be talking about this a bunch more. Jonathan, you have one more thought, and then we'll.
Yeah, just real quick. I would run her one more time against the girls, and then I would run her in the Santa Anita Derby. Right. Then, if you get the points, great. You're qualified for the Oaks. If it doesn't work out, you can back up, still win the Oaks. Blah 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 blah. But if she romps in the Santa Anita Derby, you know, and then we're talking about something different.
All right. Well, these conversations are going to be ongoing. I assume the Dorf's basic message was he isn't planning anything like that for Unique Bella. We should all go listen to the archive. You can get it on stevebick.com. Listen to his interview with Hollendorfer and all the other great work he does on there. I don't want to cannibalize too much of his show, but Jonathan, that's essentially what he was saying in this one point.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, let's move on to the Holy Bull. We're going to start with the Holy Bull, not with the winner, but with Classic Empire. Now, Jonathan has been a very active man on Twitter, getting into fights with men pretending to be women and horses pretending to be giraffes and all this other stuff. I don't even know what's going on. All I know, and this goes for you too, Mike, if I were either of you guys, I'd make a lot more liberal use of the mute button. But let's put that aside. One of the more interesting conversations you've been in recently on Twitter concerns Classic Empire. We talked on the show last week about how there had been some sort of scattered reports about him. It was from a while ago, but as recently as I think a month ago, showing some of the Rodman-like antics, refusing to train on certain days, and then there's a story going into the race about shipping it, not having a good time shipping in. I'm just starting to think that the horse is a little bit of a little too much of a head case to bet on with much confidence. Jonathan, you seem to be his biggest supporter, so we'll start with you, and then we'll segue to Mike's thoughts.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not his biggest supporter. I think he's a good horse. I think he ran really well in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. Here's what I'll say. He's by no means he's like my Derby favorite or anything like that. But I think that if people will just take a step back, pull up Tepin's PPs, and look at how they treat Tepin. Like, look at where, they don't crank her up for her first race back for these irrelevant races. And no offense to the Holy Bull or the winners of the Holy Bull. It's a great stepping stone for Kentucky Derby winners. But my point is that I just don't see how anyone can tell me that the Cassie Barn tightened every screw on Classic Empire, the 2-year-old champion and Breeders' Cup Juvenile winner, so that he could win the Holy Bull. Like, that's not the goal. And he obviously is a head case. He's proven that from what he did at Saratoga. He's proven it by having to add the blinkers. Look, I'm not running to the window like a podcast listener. I'll keep stealing this because it's a great line. I'm not going to cut in line to bet the horse next time. But what I'm saying is that performance is a little bit, I'll give him another shot. With that said, he did chase a little bit of an average pace. For the same reason, I'm not really that high on Irish War Cry. He had everything his own way. Let's just wait and see. I wouldn't rip up your Classic Empire future wagers quite yet.
What does the figure pattern look like, Mike? What did he earn? Well, I agree with what Jonathan said. Yes, he's not going to be cranked, but I still want to see improvement. Cranked or no cranked, I want to see improvement in a horse from his last start in the fall at 2 and his first start at 3. I don't want to see a giant improvement. I want to see a little. What do we have in the figures?
Yeah, it's not good. Obviously, he ran a 102 in his last start as a 2-year-old in winning the Breeders' Cup. So that he obviously regressed off of that. However... He ran the slowest race from a figure standpoint that he'd ever run, aside from his debut, where he got a 55. He ran an 83 here. He ran an 88 in the race prior to the Classic, 87 in breaking his maiden, I believe. To me, there's a difference between not cranking a horse and not having him ready for his best effort and having him show up with essentially a non-effort, which is, I think, what we got here from Classic Empire. And I don't know why that happened. There's a lot of reasons why that could be. Maybe he wasn't training right. Maybe they weren't training him enough. Maybe he was short. And I'm not a trainer, so I don't know. But one of the things, and you guys both mentioned he's a bit of a head case, he's got some issues. The stories that came out afterwards that they shipped him in the day of the race, really?
I think that's fairly common, Mike, isn't it?
I guess, but it's one thing if you've got a horse that's used to that and who handles shipping well and who's not a head case, who doesn't have a history of weird antics and who doesn't seem to be a little bit temperamental. But you've got a unanimous 2-year-old champ who, I guess, in the easiest thing I'll say is has some issues or has some quirks. Okay, wouldn't you want to get him settled and used to his surroundings before you made him run a graded stakes race, even if it wasn't your ultimate goal?
I could argue that the exact opposite way. You've got a horse who's temperamental. If he's doing well, maybe you have a program where you typically ship in the day of. You just roll the dice. If you're dealing with a horse who's temperamental, to me, it could just as easily go wrong the other way. Oh, all of a sudden he's out of his element. He has time to worry. I think this is a case where you just have to decide if you trust the trainer or not. Personally, I'm going to trust Mark Cassie to make the right decision about that. What do you think, Jonathan?
Yeah, no, I mean, you hear a lot of guys say that it's a lot less of a stressful situation when you just ship him in and run rather than get him there overnight and have him all worked up and then they're there, blah, 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 blah. So, that's one thing I'll definitely defer to the experts on. I don't know enough about training a horse to identify which one of those ideas is probably best, but I don't think that was so much the problem shipping him in.
I just think that, you know, you look at the tab, I think that, you know, they only had like four published works. Just doesn't feel like they had the horse fully ready to rock and roll, because that's just not the goal. And I don't know how much of a mental aspect is when it comes to training a horse, and, you know, if you need more time to kind of get them to kind of focus in mentally. I'm not really sure about that, but, you know, I'm not judging the horse based on just that performance. It wasn't good, but I'm not judging them.
Well, then that makes sense. And maybe I'm asking the wrong question, because you can't, I'm talking about form cycle patterns and things like that, and you can't judge that off a race that should just be X'd out. You know what I mean? And clearly, the horse had problems shipping. The figure is so dramatically off. We're not talking about, like, in a way, I'd feel worse about the race if it was a 90 than it being as low as it is, just because it just reeks of a total non-effort attributable to other things. So I guess for me, I mean, hey, if everybody wants to jump off the bandwagon and we have a chance after some good works and no more reports of him tearing up the nightclubs of Paris or whatever to come back for his next race, maybe he would make sense there. But if I have to pay a premium because he's Classic Empire with all the attendant question marks, that's what I'm not in a hurry to do. Any other thoughts before we move on to the winner? Jonathan already sort of gave his assessment, but anything else on Classic Empire?
Yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, I think you ultimately have to view that race as a mulligan. He earned his free pass, and he, you know, you just strike a line through it and figure he's better than what we saw in Holy Bull. However, you're right. I think a lot of people are going to do the same. They're going to see him as the unanimous two-year-old champ, and you're just not going to get a price on him going forward for a horse who clearly has some head case issues, regardless of whatever else is going on from a training standpoint. I don't know if I can rely on him.
Well, that I would definitely not want to rely too heavily, but it could be interesting if the value is there. What is the plan for Classic Empire?
I don't know. I just know that they're not going to run him again at Gulfstream. Cassie came out and talked to Marty McGee after the race and said they're not planning on running at Gulfstream anymore. Maybe Tampa Bay Derby, I think, is in the plans. We'll see.
I wouldn't want to run against that Todd horse that he debuted in NHC Week.
Yeah, that horse looked pretty good.
Always, or something with an A. I
can't remember. Or McCracken. McCracken's going to be, I mean, he'll run this weekend. I think McCracken's a good one. He's one I'm
looking forward to. Then again, maybe if you're viewing Classic Empire as a little bit behind and you really believe he's the best, maybe you don't worry too much about that. You know, maybe you say, hey, let's see what we got here against some of the best and then formulate a plan from there. So it's not crazy to me that they'd go that route. Do you have any info, JK, where they at?
I don't. I have no information. I do know that they've got a string at Fairgrounds, I believe, so maybe that's a possibility. I would imagine that the ultimate goal is going to be the Bluegrass, considering that he won a race over that course. The Cassies are usually pretty prominent at Keeneland, so probably just finding the next stepping stone to get to the Bluegrass.
We've talked a little bit about Irish War Cry. Jonathan expressed some skepticism. Mike, what were your views, and what kind of figure did the winner get in the Holy Bull?
I believe the winner got a 97, which was the top speed figure of the three Derby preps we had this weekend. You know, he was good. He kind of had it all his own way on the front end, and it was his first time going long. And, you know, he fortunately was able to open up and met the two-year-old champ on clearly his off day. So I don't know how good he is. This may be as good as he is. Or maybe he continues to improve for a trainer who knows what it takes to win the Kentucky Derby in Grand Motion.
I'm going to take the positive view here. Grand Motion, not exactly known for, you know, one-way speed horses or horses who don't train on. This is a guy whose horse is typically developed and typically finish. So for a horse to have enough tactical speed to do what Irish War Cry did, and who'd shown the ability in terms of late pace figures to close well in the past, this is a horse I'm looking at to continue to train on, and I'm kind of interested in. Do you think I'm being naive here, Jonathan?
No, I don't think you're being naive. I have no problem with everything you just said, but the only issue that I'm having is that I just can't. He's going to be short next time he runs, and
sure.
Off of just, you know, and look, I
price,
you don't listen.
Not fitness, you mean, of course.
Yes, yes, yes. If you don't listen to Steve Bick, you should. Andy Sterling was on today and brought up a great point. People tend
to forget about basic handicapping principles in big races, especially Triple Crown preps. They just throw it out the window, like, because they just become so fanatical about the event, they forget. He set slow fractions on the front end and had things his own way. If it was a Wednesday at Aqueduct, you're not betting that horse back.
No, that's fair. I mean, I think there are mitigating factors in terms of the trainer. You know, I view that stuff sometimes very much in that context. But, right, if the crowd's going to get too enamored, again, not unlike what I said with Classic Empire, I'm not necessarily interested in paying a premium for that. Well, that's one where I consider the horse a contender and let the market guide how much I'm going to use. Two Andy Sterling puts in one show. Are you going to send him a royalty check, JK?
He was nice this morning to Steve, which was surprising.
Was he eating breakfast while he was on the show?
I'm not. Just stop. He was in a good mood.
No, I like Andy a lot. I like Andy a lot. But he is mean. He is mean to Steve. But I think it's a little bit of a. I think it's a little bit of a shtick they do.
I think it's a shtick too.
So they're very friendly to one another in person.
Those guys are tight, and we've made fun of you enough, Jonathan. So I got to, just for 12 seconds, Mike. Why knock an 8-1 shot? Why do it ever?
What are you getting at, Pete? What are you getting? I mean, come on, man. Half the field scratches out of the race, right?
So that's your.
I mean, come on, come on. You're highlighting Isotherm, and you're not talking about at the top of the stretch. It looked like a great time. Might actually pull off a 35-1 upset. You know, jeez, come on, cherry pick here, Pete.
Did we have any other successes in our race picking last weekend? I was not be doing my well. It's two things. I was tempted to say I didn't do my homework taking notes, but that's not exactly true. The difference is I was in the Brooklyn bunker for that, and I'm back sitting in this car at a parking lot at the Key Food because it's alternate side of the street parking here in Brooklyn. So I just don't have my notes with me.
I'll also take one more shot at you, Pete. Please. Easy for you to say since you didn't handicap these races.
That's true. I haven't handicapped a race for the show other than the Wizards, where I gave out a 40 to 1 shot that didn't run in about 6 weeks. But that's about to change. My handicapping siesta is just about over.
Okay, good.
But did you guys have any win? I apologize. I thought you did have one, which is why I asked. But how did we do in terms of the public handicapper races giving picks?
I don't even remember the races. What were they? Geez. I just need a reminder.
I don't think we did all that. The Keith G, it was the Brad Cox, Florent Giroux horse, who I think I mentioned, you know, that horse was going to be pretty bet pretty heavily. The horse won, was a very short price. We had a couple that we were against that maybe didn't run that great, but
I didn't see the flurry of tweets that usually accompanies when you guys crush it, which you do on a regular basis. I don't mean to rub your face in it too much. I just thought the Isotherm thing was funny, just because, and it's just a lesson I thought that applies to public handicappers and just racing in general. There's just very little to be gained from knocking 8-1 shots. That's all I wanted to. That's all I wanted to say.
And I was knocking a 6-1 morning line. Who you know? Anyway.
Let's move on. Got one, JK?
I didn't know that Cool Arrow scratched.
Right. Cool Arrow scratched. They ran the other one, who ran second.
So here's a good point about the races we talked about this weekend. The Swedish Chant. This is just an example of using the notes in DRF Formulator. I put a huge note that before the race, Chad said, this is going to be a little bit short for Rimska. She's going to be better longer. Well, if she's going to be better longer, damn, she's going to be pretty good.
That's a good note. Mm. That's a very good note, as impressive as she was. So they're getting the job done. That's a very good point about following trainer quotes. And another benefit, we talked a little bit before about the DRF articles and why to have a Plus subscription. Well, combining your Plus subscription and your Formulator notes, you can take stuff like that, slug it right in your PPs. Then when these horses come back, you'll have those quotes right in there. Sometimes I'll do that exact thing. Chad, : open quote, she's going to be better longer. You see that, you know, to project improvement when that's the situation that occurs. Let's talk about the way there's not much to talk about here. Ella Reeb predictably put on a little bit of a show. What do we get in terms of a buyer speed figure there, Mike?
I think that was a 93, 92.
Okay.
92.
picking it up, a little bit, but probably not enough under those circumstances to have anybody running to bet a Derby future. Or was I missing any aspect of it? What did you think of the performance, JK?
Well, I thought he was good. I thought there wasn't a lot in there. I think he was supposed to win the race, and he did what he was supposed to do. He's a nice horse. Good for Trevor McCarthy.
Good point.
I'm glad to see him do well. He paid for dinner one night when we were at Keeneland, so I always root for him.
That's all you have to do. Pay for JK's dinner. Buy him a $75 breakfast. You got a friend for life.
Yeah, that's all it takes. It's real simple. It's an easy game.
Let's talk about the Bob Lewis, the much maligned Bob Lewis. I got to be honest. I didn't understand like all the hate for this race on Twitter. And Mike, I think you were leading the chorus with their pitchforks and torches for not liking this race. But
well,
I mean, you know, they have a lot of different. Maybe the comment is there shouldn't be so many different prep races out there at this time of year, so we can see some bigger fields. Like I get that, but I didn't think it was a terrible collection of horses all in all for this stage of the year, and Royal Mo got the job done. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know what to make of the race. He got a 93. He broke a little slowly and then took the lead and wired the field. And the rest of the field kind of floated out a little wide on the first turn, and I think the race was kind of over at that point. I don't know if he's won. He'll have to improve going forward. You know, it was a five-horse field. I think that's part of the reason why there was a little bit of criticism about it, especially considering that there are a lot of really good horses out on the West Coast that are on the Triple Crown Trail. 95% of them are trained by Bob Baffert. None of them showed up for the race. So that's the disappointing part of it for me. Royal Mo is good. Maybe he's even as good as his stablemate in Gormley. But I just don't know where he fits with the rest of the crew.
What do we know about, we'll ask Jonathan, he's got the wig ready to bust it out at any time to do his Baffert dance. what are the plans, do you know, Jonathan, for the big Baffert horses? When are we going to see their return to the races and in what spots? Do you have any information?
No, I'll tell you what, Steve Vick's going to owe me dinner too. I just want to give credit. I heard Baffert on Vick earlier this week, and he said that he is going to send one of them, whether it's Mastery or American Anthem, probably to the Rebel, and the other one will stay in California. So, you know, he did this in the past with Dortmund and American Pharoah. He sent American Pharoah East and kept Dortmund there. I think it's more of a people, you know, fanboy Eric Bilek of Dortmund at one point tried to suggest that it was because he liked Dortmund more and he kept him there. But I think it's more of which horse he feels more comfortable with shipping. It's really important to Baffert. It seems like he always talks about horses that ship well, and so if Mastery is a little bit more of a tough one to get on a plane, then obviously American Anthem would go, and then vice versa if it's the other way around. So I think he's going to split those guys up and go from there.
Now, I don't understand why you think that Bick owes you. I'd say if it wasn't for quoting Andy Serling or Steve Bick, you wouldn't have had much to say on this podcast. I think you owe him, dude.
Man, I tell you what, Pete's going in on me today.
I'm salty. I'm salty today. You know,
he's just mad because I reminded him about the four orange juices, and he got his credit. He got his credit card bill.
Ain't no free, Jonathan. You know, in theory it was, but I'll get it. I'll explain.
Take it out in pain. Later. Take it out in pain, as Leonard Cohen says.
Barb's on the podcast. Do you have? By the way, do you happen to have Mike? Just to completely go off left here for a second, since I talked NFL with Jonathan for 10 minutes. Now we're going to do 2 minutes of rock and roll with Mike. Did you get that last Leonard Cohen album? You Want It Darker?
I did. It's nice. It's good.
I like it. I like it a lot. I was just going to recommend it if you didn't already have it. I mean, it lives up to the name.
For sure.
You listen to some of those lyrics and, you know, it's you got to be probably in the right frame of mind. But
for sure, there's a really dark lyric, something about, you know, he died to make things cheap or something like that. Something really sarcastic.
That sounds like social commentary.
Yeah.
All right. That's enough of that. I think we have time for one quick question. Remember, I mentioned last show, we had several questions we hadn't gotten to. I want to get to at least one of them. This loops back into the tournament discussion. It comes from Hoosier Capper, who I appreciate taking the opportunity to go ahead and resubmit the question. And Hoosier Capper says, my goal is to earn a spot at the NHC next year, but how is attending as a spectator? Would love to hear your thoughts. Mike and I are probably better to answer this one than Jonathan, just because, Jonathan, if I'm correct, you've never been to the NHC as a spectator, only a participant?
Well, the last 2 years, on day three, I've been a spectator.
Well, now you're making fun of yourself. I've started a trend. But all right, well then, with that in mind, what are your thoughts on attending as a spectator on day three?
It's fun. It's an unbelievable event. It would be hard to go by yourself and don't know someone. I mean, if you have like a friend who's playing, you can sit with them, you know. But even if you just go to Vegas and you run around and you bet in the room and you know, whatever. I mean, it wouldn't be a bad situation. It's a big room and you can walk. You know, you walk around freely. No one's checking IDs or badges or anything like that. So I definitely would go. And just even if you can't hang out during the day. You'll have more fun and have better conversation than you've ever had in regards to racing than hanging out in that bar right when you walk into the front of the Treasure Island, or randomly showing up to the cocktail parties that they have that all the various racing industry companies kind of put on. I mean, it's definitely worth it for sure. Without a doubt, you'd have a good time. So alone or with a group, it would definitely work out if you love the sport.
I appreciate you talking around giving a free plug to one of those non-DRF bets ADWs there, Jonathan.
You see, I was about to. I was going to be like, oh, but
you're tap dancing.
I was going to say Lux Air Jets was one that's not a competitor.
We'll plug them.
Lux Air Jets.
They put
on
a good party. They put on a very good party. But I think the idea for me would be, if you don't get qualified, ideally find a horse playing buddy. Go in for the last chance. Definitely try that. And if you don't make it, hang around and do what Jonathan says. I mean, the final table, it's kind of fun, especially when the winner is crowned. I mean, I'm not going to be honest. It's not like you're going to be riveted during the tournament, but it's a cool energy. You're almost, if you're, you know, depending on your social skills, you're going to probably not have trouble meeting some people as long as you're smart about when you approach them and all that kind of stuff. I think you could get a great weekend out of it. Mike, what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a unique opportunity to be around a bunch of horse players because, look, it's a small minority of us that watch horses and play horse racing on a regular basis. And so just to be involved and in a room where everybody is focused on that is pretty unique. And you're right. If you pick the right time and the right spot, you can meet some people that become friends for life. I'd say it's absolutely worth checking out.
All right, there you go. There's our take on that. Thank you for that question. We've got a few more questions queued up, but we are out of time today. We can bring some of those back in future shows. If you have questions for us, feel free to hit us up on Twitter. We'll do the quick roundup of Twitter handles. I'm at LoomsBoldly. Jonathan?
At UT Big Hair.
At UT Big Hair. And Mike has two.
Well, at DRF Hogan is the personal one, and then do quite a bit on at DRF Formulator as well.
But for, I guess, questions for the show, at DRF Hogan, the better one?
Yeah, probably.
You can also, if you have a longer than Twitter question, hit us up, podcast@drf.com. We love to hear from you. And that's it for today's show. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin for rolling with all my nasty comments. You know, I kid you because I love you.
Oh, I know, and I'm gonna suck out another dinner out of this deal.
I want to thank Mike Hogan, doing a fantastic job as always, putting these shows together and rolling with the punches on Twitter. Thank you, Mike.
Of course.
And most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. You're what makes the show special. We really value our interactions with the listeners and all the support we've received in these 210 episodes so far. We will be back with another show on Friday. Hey, maybe I'll even handicap for that one, but I might need one more. I might need one more week of Siesta, especially if I'm writing another Derby Trail preview for DRF.com. We'll see about that one, but
I'm not holding my breath.
My name is Peter Thomas Fortital. For those of you who started joining with the live listening midway through the show, you can catch us via Spreaker, via Facebook Live, depending on the day. But you can join in live. We typically do the shows Tuesday at 11 and Friday at 11. We will be back later this week. If you're playing, until then, may you win all your photos.